8:30, time now for the Big Picture program. And who else joins us on the line but Mr. Abubakar Dawji? Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You're not protesting?
No, not at all.
You're too old for university. even if you were vice chancellor by now, they would have forced you into retirement.
Well, then at 38, I can't retire.
Well, last week it was 47. Story that caught your eye this week.
Well, Maulana, I don't have anything outrageous that I came across, but I was quite startled by an article I came across yesterday. An amazing scientific discovery. I read it in the British Telegraph newspaper. It says, a study by scientists in Australia and Germany found that crocodiles can sleep with one eye open in a ploy that allows them to doze while watching for prey. The behavior involves keeping one half of the brain conscious and the eye connected to that half of the brain is open, which allows the crocodile to monitor surrounding events and keep a watch for potential threats or prey. Dear listeners, isn't that absolutely amazing? Half the brain of the crocodile is sleeping, and so it can close one eye and watch with the other one. Well, let me say that actually I am not surprised at all by this discovery. Not at all. In fact, I myself came across this phenomenon long time ago. In fact, during my travels overseas, when I'm in the bus traveling from one place to another, usually it's a long journey, and I'm giving a lecture, which I think is very interesting, I have found many bullies sleeping with one eye open, pretending to be listening to me. Half their brain is fast asleep, totally unconscious. And then when I see them, I deliberately ask the bully, who is knocked out, but one eye is open, I ask, so, I'm sure, Mr. Khan, that you will agree with me that United States President Benjamin Netanyahu will be the one to liberate Palestine. With a shock, Khan wakes up and says, yes, 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 inshallah. So, dear listeners, my research has shown that many people who travel with me are related to crocodiles. And I'm sure that the way some taxi drivers behave on the roads, they definitely have crocodile in their ancestry. But now let me turn to something that really, really irritates me, something serious, something in the media. It's the way that new terms keep popping up regarding, they pop up regularly to describe Muslims. Muslims are involved in some violent activity, either mindless acts of killing or legitimate resistance to oppression. Long ago, we heard the term repeatedly, fundamentalist, Muslim fundamentalist. That was the flavor of the day. That was the word that we use often. Amazing how the fighters, the Mujahideen who fought against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, were described by the U.S. media as freedom fighters. But when they chased the Russians out and turned their guns at the new enemy, the United States, they were described as Muslim fundamentalist terrorists. What is a Muslim fundamentalist? A Muslim who believes in the fundamentals of his religion? So what's wrong with that? Well, that word implied a person who studied his religion so deeply that he found at his heart, deep inside his religion, a call, an instruction to go out and kill for no reason. Kill, 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 like a zombie, like a robot, brainwashed, like a Terminator. Hasta la vista, baby. Dish, dish, kill the infidels. Then another term was added, extremists, Muslim fundamentalist extremists. What is that supposed to mean? And now we have graduated to some new terms. One is the word jihadist. So what is a jihad? Or what is jihad? In Islam, jihad is a noble, respectable act. A fight against evil, a fight against those who attack Muslims and Islam. In short, that is what it is. The meaning of jihad, has now been twisted, made ugly. Anyone who has a Muslim name, shoots innocent people, is described as a jihadist. If he wears a Palestinian scarf, all the better. And if he shouts Allahu Akbar, that would be the cherry on the top, the clincher, as they say, the confirmation this man is a jihadist, a dirty, rotten killer, a monster. So you see the relationship? Jihadist equals killer of innocent people for no reason, a monster. And now, dear listeners, the term I hate the most, Islamist. Islamist. What does it mean? We hear the media using it all the time. Islamist. Islamist. What does it mean? Islamist, a killer of innocent people for no reason. A monster who is motivated by his religion to go out and kill. His religion makes him kill. Hasta la vista, baby. Lots of crazy Arnold Schwarzeneggers and Charles Bronsons and dirty Harry Clint Eastwoods. The word Islam appears in the term Islamist. So the reference is direct. Islam is a danger to the world. Finish and klar. Khalas. That's what it means. What does Islamist mean, really? Islamist. The word mist, like a spray. Maulana, you know what? I think it's a good idea. It's a good name for a deodorant. Islamist. Just one spray of the new Islamist deodorant, and it is guaranteed to take the smell out of your nafs. Just one spray of the new Islamist deodorant on your kids will stop them from watching too much TV. A few squirts of the Islamist deodorant on your teenage son, and he will give up drugs and join the Tabligh Jamaat. One spray on your husband, and he will give up golf on a Sunday and take you shopping every Sunday. Buy the new 500ml bottle of Islamist deodorant now, and get a free 250ml can of pesticide, the all-new cockroach killer known as Jihadist. You know, Maulana, I think these new products are winners, eh? What do you think? Let's go into business, okay?
Yeah. There are many people, Uncle Abi, who are looking at developments in the Muslim world, and they find it confusing and difficult to understand. Can you make sense of it for them?
Now, let me deal with something that I have been thinking about recently. If you are looking for integrity, honesty, truth, and justice on the world's political stage, you will really find it there. What you will find is hypocrisy, double standards, dishonesty, self-interest, and so on. And central to all of this is power. Yes, power. If you are powerful, you can virtually get away with murder, both literally and figuratively. The world is ruled by the simple motto, might is right. Once you understand that, all confusions disappear completely. Everything is cleared. The US President George Bush lied in order to bomb Iraq and murder 200,000 people. How can he do that? Easy. The US has got the power. Obama sends drones all over the world to kill people. No fair trial, no concern for international law, nothing at all. How can he do that? Easy. The US has the power. Russia supports an uprising in Ukraine. The U.S. calls on the world to condemn Russia and imposes sanctions. Hey, but wait. Russia also has power. So America can't just go and kick Putin's backside as he did to Saddam when he invaded Kuwait in 1990. And Russia has enough power to defy America in Syria. The U.S. said, stay out of Syria, told Russia. Stay out of Syria. Russia said, protect. Now instructions have been given by the White House to American pilots. If you see Russian planes flying over Syrian skies, stay out of their way. Avoid them completely. The underlying message, of course, is We don't want a confrontation. Why? Simple, dear people, because Russia also has the power. Don't mess with it. Yesterday, British Prime Minister took the Chinese President Xi Jinping to his local pub to try out the British traditional meal of fish and chips. And over the past few days, he has been hosted, the Chinese Prime Minister, the Chinese President, has been hosted at gala dinners, big, lavish banquets. And the big one was attended by the Queen herself and all the cabinet ministers. Isn't that strange? Britain describes itself as a democracy that allows freedoms and respects citizen rights and so on and so on. China, on the other hand, is known as a, well, as a closed society, a police state. There are not many freedoms. Some people demonstrated in London against Xi's visit. And I'm reading from the Mercury of, let's see what's the date here. It's Wednesday. Cameron also hopes to, wait, where are we now? Right, it says here, Xi's visit shows that England does not give a damn about human rights, said Aisha Nahmaka, 24 years old, from South London, one of those demonstrating in the streets there. A leader of China's Muslim Uyghur minority said, the red carpet being laid out by Britain was stained with the blood of his people. Hundreds have been killed in violence in the region, blamed by Beijing on Islamic militants. So, how come Britain can embrace China so warmly? And the answer is easy. China is powerful. Its economy is strong. It's got lots of money. Money that it can invest in friendly nations. Let me read from the same article. It says that Cameron also hopes to attract investment in infrastructure, nuclear power, and his government's planned transformation of northern England. So, roll out the red carpet and roll out the royal family and don't speak about human rights and freedoms. So what does Xi Jinping mean? Do you know, Maulana? What does Xi Jinping mean?
No idea.
I will tell you. It means ka-ching, ka-ching. You get my point, eh? That's the sound of cash registers. Ka-ching, ka-ching. So what was that again? Might is right. Okay, my China? Let's leave the so-called West alone and see if any of our guys got any power. All are quite hopeless. Maybe Turkey's got some power, but hang on here. There are some, the Gulf states, Qatar, Oman, Bahrain, and the rest. And of course, the Lani of them all is Saudi Arabia. How are they powerful? Well, they've got pots and pots of money, and money can buy you lots of toys and lots of influence. And those who sell toys are ready to lick your boots. But wait, once again, dear listeners, I have a very exciting announcement to make. The custodians have just released a statement that planes will be sent all around the world to pick up anyone wishing to perform Umrah free of charge. Excellent hotels will be provided free, three meals, and also 5,000 riyals per person spending money. And you can stay as long as you like. How's that, eh? The custodians are so generous, man. I really like them. But hang on, wait a minute. Breaking news. A new statement has just come through. Bad news, eh? The Umrah deal has been cancelled. The money is required for something much, much more important. So let me read to you from a Reuters report. The U.S. government said on Tuesday it has approved the sale of up to four Lockheed Martin multi-mission warships plus associated equipment, training and logistics to Saudi Arabia, a deal valued at $11.25 billion overall. Multiply that by 13.5,
sure,
and you'll get the rands. And this is what one U.S. official said. This sale demonstrates the enduring U.S. commitment to building robust diplomatic and security partnerships essential to promoting peace and stability in the Gulf region. Let me translate that for you, dear listeners. We will lick your boots because you got the money. We will let you bomb Yemen to smithereens. Innocents are killed. Wedding functions are blown up. You lock up people who criticize you or women who drive. So what? Big deal. Big deal. The only big deals we are concerned with is the planes and tanks that you buy from us. You got the buying power. That's all that matters. And dear listeners, what about the what we are taught, that if you kill one innocent person, then it's like killing an entire nation? But isn't the killing of innocent people now known as collateral damage? War is hell. In order to get the bad guys, some good guys will die. That's life, bro. And the custodians are also respected, or should I say, their money is respected. Vast mountains of Falus of the Saudis is also respected by the British. Here's something from the British Observer newspaper of last Sunday. Headline, revealed how U.S. targets Saudis for top contracts. Documents show that the controversial kingdom is seen as a priority market for British companies. Documents seen by Observer show the government identifying Saudi Arabia as a priority market and encouraging UK businesses to bid for contracts in health, security, defense and justice. The UK has licensed £4 billion times 20 to get rands, £4 billion of arms sales to the Saudis since the Conservative came to power in 2010, according to research by Campaign Against Arms Trade. Around 240 Ministry of Defense civil servants and military personnel work in the UK and Saudi Arabia to support the contracts, which will next year include delivery of 22 Hawk jets in a deal worth $1.6 billion. And research by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute shows that the UK is now the kingdom's largest arms supplier, responsible for 36% of all Saudi arm imports. And as I'm reading this, Maulana, I'm thinking, next year they're going to buy 22 Hawk jets. Wow, I wonder how many Hajis you can fit into that, bringing them to Saudi Arabia. Anyway, there you are, folks. Britain is also cashing in. Nothing wrong with that. Our dear custodians need to be protected. They are the royal family, after all. When it comes to power, you can't beat one very tiny state, a small country which you can't, well, you can barely see on the map. Yes, you guessed it, Israel. It never ceases to amaze me, Maulana, how much of power Israel has. Of course, it's got a very powerful army, more powerful than the combined armies of all the Arab countries around it. Egypt, Jordan, Syria. Israel is much more powerful than the combined armies of all the countries in the region. And its nuclear weapons, which number over 300, ensures that it is untouchable. So it's very powerful. But what makes it even more powerful is that it has got the so-called superpower under its control. Lock, stock and barrel. And I like to repeat what a former congressman, Pat Buchanan, said. The U.S. Congress is Israeli occupied territory. Of course, you know all of this already. The U.S. veto at the U.N. at any steps to criticize Israel, Israel's blatant disregard for international law, and so on and so on. Everyone knows very clearly that Israel is oppressing the Palestinians. It's so clear, starkly clear. But people, that's top people, politicians, stop short of condemning Israel. Ban Ki-moon met Netanyahu 2 days ago. What did he tell him? Mr. Prime Minister, the violence is no good. The violence is no good. Innocent people are dying. Both sides must go back to negotiations for a two-state solution. Well, if I hear the word two-state solution again, Maulana, I'm going to take my talwar, which you can see on my WhatsApp profile, and cut off the speaker's delicate parts. Our Ban Ki-moon Sahib, I like that, eh? Our Ban Ki-sahib, can never tell Netanyahu, now, look here, stop building settlements, stop provoking the Palestinians by allowing more and more fanatics into Al-Aqsa. Stop killing young protesters. Stop all your brutal action and stop your occupation. Well, you can't do that, eh? Because Israel has the power. And yesterday, John Kerry met Netanyahu and said to him, the situation is very dangerous, and if it escalates, it can become more dangerous. These mamparas, these eunuchs, and eunuchs can never speak the truth to power. And therefore, Netanyahu answered Kerry with the usual nonsense. He told him, the reason why there is violence is because of the incitement from Mahmoud Abbas, meaning that if Abbas didn't put some dangerous ideas into the heads of all these young Palestinians, gave them some dangerous instructions, then Palestinians will go about their lives very happily and not complain at all, you see? So it's Abbas, the instigator of all the violence. Everyone knows that this is plain rubbish. But can you imagine John Kerry turning to Netanyahu and say, sorry, Prime Minister, but I think you are talking sheer garbage. If he did, Netanyahu will make one phone call to the U.S. Congress, and next minute, Kerry will be standing with the cardboard sign at the robots in Washington, D.C. Netanyahu can say anything. Basically, it's the Palestinians' fault that they are suffering and dying. If they didn't resist, if they don't resist in any way at what Israel is doing to them every day, then there will be peace. Blame the Palestinians, and not Netanyahu is getting extremely desperate. And this week, he scraped the bottom of the barrel to blame the Palestinians. The story is this. There was this chap called Hitler. He was just a nice, simple, caring fellow who became the leader of Germany. He didn't really hate the Jews. He just wanted to relocate them, maybe to greener pastures, somewhere better outside of Germany. And then along came the Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini. He met Hitler in Berlin and planted some evil ideas into his innocent Nadan leader, into the head of this innocent Nadan leader. He told him, listen boss, don't relocate these Jews because they will come to Palestine. Hitler was puzzled. And he said, so Haji, what should I do, Habibi? And the Mufti said, burn them. And so, dear listeners, that's how we had the Holocaust. So you see the message. It's the Palestinians who cause all the trouble. That is what Netanyahu said this week. Well, it was so absolutely silly that even those who usually turn a deaf ear to such nonsense that he speaks regularly gave him a tight clap. Let me read very quickly from yesterday's newspaper. It says that Netanyahu, whose father was an eminent historian, was quickly harangued by opposition politicians and experts on the Holocaust, who said that he was distorting the historical record. Even Netanyahu's defense minister, close ally Moshe Yalon, said the prime minister had got it wrong. It certainly wasn't Husseini who invented the final solution. But the point several historians made was that Netanyahu was distorting timelines and drawing false conclusions. The meeting between Husseini and Hitler in Berlin took place on November 28, 1941, more than 2 years earlier, in January 1939. Hitler had addressed the Reichstag and talked clearly about his determination to exterminate the Jewish race. And this is what Dina Porat, a professor at Tel Aviv University and the chief historian of the Holocaust Museum, told Israeli radio. To say that the Mufti was the first to mention to Hitler the idea to kill or burn the Jews is not correct. The idea to rid the world of the Jews was a central theme of Hitler's ideology a long, long time before he met the Mufti. For somebody who knows something about history and grew up in the house of historian Professor Ben-Zion Netanyahu, he should know well. But in my humble opinion, to say that the Mufti gave Hitler the idea is wrong. So, there you are. And now, let me change gears completely. Have I got a few minutes, Molina?
Yes, you can go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you can go ahead.
Right. Let me change gears a little bit, and still on the subject of power. Something happened this week that had my flabber completely gasted. Yes, I actually fell off my chair. It was so amazing, almost inconceivable, mind-blowing. The ANC hosted Hamas. Khalid Mishal, the head of Hamas's Politburo, was given red carpet treatment. So what's so startling about that? Well, let me tell you. Israel talks to Fatah of Yasser Arafat and then subsequently of Mahmoud Abbas. Israel says Hamas is a terrorist organization. This is echoed by Western countries, especially the United States. Fatah is kosher and Hamas is not. So, post-1994, our government spoke only to Fatah. That was the safest position. You don't want to upset Israel, and more particularly its bodyguard, the United States. If the U.S. gets upset, then you could lose all those wonderful trade deals we have with America. America has the power to sabotage our economy. So firstly, our government was on safe ground speaking to Fatah. And secondly, and more importantly, the ANC was under no pressure at all to talk to Hamas. No pressure from anyone. That's important. So why did the ANC risk talking to Hamas? Not only that, but rolling out the red carpet, knowing full well that there could be a backlash. Why did it defy the power of the United States and Israel? That's a big question mark, and one can only speculate. There must be some gain somewhere. It was a huge leap. And leaving the questions aside, I, for one, applaud the move. It shows one thing, integrity. Wow, I just said at the start, it's so lacking on the world stage. And here we have demonstration of integrity, a demonstration of the movement's ideals. We fought for our liberation, and therefore we have to support a movement that is fighting to liberate its people from oppression. It was long overdue, of course, but it's nevertheless very, very much welcome. Full marks to the ANC. And dear listeners, did you read the interview with Khalid Mishal that was published in all our papers? You didn't? May I suggest that you get hold of it? It sets out clearly the policy, the thinking of Hamas. If you want a copy, email me, abie@iafrica.com. Very educational indeed.
Light at the end of the tunnel.
Ronnie is from Mirbank, as we all know. His father, Moon, and mother, Sylvie, they live in Shellcross. They are 78 years old. They are sitting in the veranda. It's a lovely afternoon. Sylvie turns to Moon and says, "Sweetie, remember when we just got married, how you used to casually, every now and then, used to reach out and take my hand? That was so nice." And Moon smiled and leaned over and took her wrinkled hand and gently massaged it. Then Sylvie said, "And remember how you used to be so romantic, eh? You used to just lean over and suddenly just give me a kiss on the cheek." And Moon smiled and leaned over and kissed her wrinkled face. Then Sylvie felt so nice. So she decided to go further. And she said, "And do you remember how you used to gently nibble my earlobes?" At that, Moon stood up slowly and started going inside the house. And Sylvie became very alarmed and said, "Hey, Moon, darling, where are you going?" And he replied, "I'm going to get my teeth."
Uncle Abe, as always, jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated.
Always a pleasure, Maulana.
Make dua for us.
Inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Abe Dawji with this week's edition of the Big Picture Program.